What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the prominent author, feminist, and academic, Dr. Susanna Heschel, talking about her new book of Abraham Joshua Heschel's essential writings. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom! It's the 9th anniversary of the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends this morning, and that is cause for celebration. Even after a week when the U.S. economy seemingly again teetered on the brink of chaos, this time more or less self-induced. More about that later, but for now, we have some celebrating to do. Because over the course of 9 great years, we here at Too Jewish have explored every corner of the Jewish world, asked and tried to answer all the questions, and interviewed everybody of importance in Jewish life from everywhere around the world. While it has been an absolute delight, a machaya, to create and host Too Jewish, it has also been a kind of sacred trust, or maybe both a sacred and secular trust, to examine all the issues, ideas, and people of importance in the Jewish world in an honest and open way. And of course, we have selflessly provided unparalleled Jewish entertainment value for you each and every week at no cost. Now, if you want to donate to Too Jewish to help us continue to flourish in the coming 10th year, email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com, TOOJewishRadio@yahoo. We accept bills of all denominations and every currency. Although, considering the state of the dollar now, gold might be the best choice for this Too Jewish anniversary. To play us in on this celebratory morning, we'll enjoy our now traditional and yet classic Shehechianu, the Prayer for All Happy Occasions by Meyer Machtenberg, sung by former guest cantor Alberto Mizrahi. Blessed are you, God, who gives us life, sustains us, and brings us to such a happy occasion. Was from the CD by the Western Winds, Abe Mizrahi, singing the prayer thanking God for all celebrations, like the 9th anniversary of Too Jewish. Now, while I am profoundly grateful to God for the health and the ability to teach and explore and enjoy and entertain in the amazing diversity of Judaism every week on the air, I am also very grateful to you, our listening audience, because you are what makes this show go and grow and flourish. You and our, you know, sponsors. Now, last week I had a very cool experience and a bittersweet one that relates to this anniversary show, and therein lies a tale. You see, 1 year ago this morning, we celebrated our 8th Two Jewish anniversary with a special guest, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. She was, as always, sincere, charming, thoughtful, and dedicated. Well, last week I served as camp rabbi at the Reform Movement-affiliated Hess Kramer Gindling Hilltop Camps in Los Angeles. Actually, in Malibu. Nice spot for a kid's camp. Anyway, while there, I saw a number of kids from my own temple, plus a large number of adults and children with whom I have strong connections through the synagogue or the community or my family. As always, there's something wonderfully affirming about the interconnectedness of the Jewish people, especially when met in a beautiful Jewish setting. And there's nothing like a kid from your home congregation running up and shouting, "Rabbi," and giving you a big hug. While people tend not to think about camp as work, there's plenty of that. But generally speaking, it's fun work. The first two sessions I taught were Ask the Rabbi forums with kids from 3rd through 7th grade. For some reason, both groups asked me about life after death in Jewish belief. As always, when I teach about this, I started by noting that I couldn't be wrong, or if I was, no one would know for, God willing, a very long time. We explored the various Jewish views on afterlife and heaven and hell for a bit, and then concluded that what we do in this life, before death, is what really matters to Jews and to God. But in view of certain events last week, when I was asked to speak to the camp at services, I went a different way. I started by talking about the Gvurot prayer, which in the traditional liturgy praises God who raises the dead to life, in Hebrew, Mechaye HaMetim. That notion of resurrecting the dead goes back 2,500 years, and the concept of bodily resurrection has long been a problem for Reform Jews. In the Pittsburgh Platform of 1878, they took Tchiyat HaMetim, bodily resurrection, straight out of the belief system and excised it from the prayer book. While most liberal Jews, the non-Orthodox ones, agree that in the literal sense, resurrection of the dead is not a belief we share. But the new Reform prayer book, in spite of great controversy among some Reform rabbis, put it back in. The natural world, they said, revives from its winter torpor each year, giving life to what seems dead. This is a metaphor for God's power to give life. Surely we can accept that God can bring anything back to life if God chooses. You know, I like that. And the hopeful energy it creates in those who might feel spiritually dead, for example. But sometimes the notion of resurrecting the dead takes on more meaning, and it did last week. You all know about our friend, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' shooting on January 8, 2011, the fact that she was very widely reported dead, and that from the injuries she received, she probably should have died. And you know of the miraculous and heroic efforts that kept her alive, and you know as well that although full recovery remains difficult to believe in, Gabby Giffords has exceeded expectations throughout her struggle to regain her voice and her health. And you also know that a week ago on Monday, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords went on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives and voted on an important bill. It was an amazing recovery, a spectacular triumph. You know, it doesn't really matter what the bill was. I mean, it was only the continuation of the U.S. government's functioning, of course, the debt ceiling mess that has led to so many bad things last week. But what really matters is that in its own way, this was an amazing example of life after death, a ray of hope and promise and the miraculous in a world sorely in need of all of those. At our camp prayer service, we sang a Misha Berach, a prayer for healing for Gabby Giffords. And I ask you two Jewish listeners on this anniversary show to offer a personal one yourself today for her. She needs it and deserves it. And so do we. And if she can heal, then there's hope for all of us, isn't there? In every area of our lives. When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, the prominent author, academic, and feminist Susanna Heschel, and talk about her dad, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, when we come back on this 9th anniversary edition of Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Do you ever say to yourself, I just don't know what I feel like eating? You know you're hungry, but for what? Of course, I could try to tempt you with a Mama's Pizza. It's got mountains of fresh cheese, acres of sauce, and a crust that's so flavorful. Yes, a Mama's Pizza is always tempting, especially when you think about its aroma just as it's ready to come out of the oven. And what can you say about our toppings? How about meaty, crunchy, spicy, fresh, flavorful, delicious? There's no doubt when your mind is unsure about what your stomach is craving, hearing about a hot, fresh Mama's Pizza might just help you decide. But I'm out of time, so I guess I'll have to wait until later to give you the details about the delicious cheesiness and tantalizing nature of our hot, fresh pizza. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school, and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We are delighted to welcome our guest to Jewish this morning, Susanna Heschel. She's the Eli Black Professor of Jewish Studies at Dartmouth. Her scholarship ranges across a wide and rich part of important Jewish ideas in the 19th and 20th century, Jewish-Christian relations in Germany. She's written extensively on Abraham Geiger and the Jewish Jesus, which won a National Jewish Book Award. And she has a new book out on Abraham Joshua Heschel, his essential writings. She edited, selected it with her own introduction. That happens to be her dad. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I didn't even mention your extensive feminist credentials, but let's talk a little bit about why you decided to come out with this book of essential writings from your dad.
Well, this book is part of a series published by Orbis Press, which is a Catholic publishing house. And my father's writings are actually very well known by Catholic theologians and lay people. Many of them use my father's writings for meditation and to deepen their own Catholic faith. And so I was asked to edit this volume for a series. I believe my father may be the only Jewish theologian in that series. And I was happy to have a chance to select passages that are especially important to me, some of my favorites, and also to publish some things that had not yet been published.
You know, and of course your dad, Abraham Joshua Heschel, the renowned theologian in really as influential, I think, in the Reform movement as in the conservative movement and Judaism on the Jewish side of the ledger. It's always a difficult question when someone has a parent of such tremendous prominence. You're prominent in your own right. Have you felt yourself affirming or avoiding your dad's eminence?
I tell you, I loved my father very much, and I also love his work and everything that he stood for. I admire him, and I think he's right in the positions that he took when he was alive regarding civil rights and efforts to make peace and interfaith relations. So I'm happy to be able to speak about him when I give lectures and to edit his work and bring his writings to the attention of other people and to write about him, what he was like as a father.
You know, it's funny. I asked that question and because I get that question sometimes. My parents, father and grandfather, are as nearly as well known as Heschel, but it isn't, I've never felt any of the weight, the sort of Ol HaTorah that people talk about. In creating this volume, what do you think is unique about it? Is it just the work that didn't get published before?
Well, no, actually, I think it's bringing together certain writings, excerpts from writings, into a unity. So there are pieces from different stages of my father's life and different books that he wrote on different topics, but somehow they come together. So, you know, my father felt when he was writing about peace or about civil rights, and he was also writing about religiosity. And maybe I can just give you an example.
Please.
So I started out my my introduction by telling about something that happened once. My father went to a demonstration against the war in Vietnam, and there was a journalist who came over to him and in a rather unfriendly way said, "What are you doing here?" And my father said to him, "I'm here because I can't pray." And the journalist said, "What do you mean you can't pray? So you come to a demonstration against the war in Vietnam?" And my father said, "When I open the prayer book, I see before me images of children burning from napalm. How can I pray?"
We will talk much more extensively with Susanna Heschel about her father, Abraham Joshua Heschel, and about some of her own work when we come back this morning on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
"My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too."
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
"When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here."
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
"I don't even consider them staff, they're friends."
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio. You don't call, you don't write, you don't email, you don't Facebook, you don't tweet. What's wrong with you? You sure you're Jewish? Anyway, or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes store, is very popular podcasts. Enormous peaceful protests have roiled Israel the past 2 weeks, and it's taken the world some time to figure out exactly what is going on. You see, unlike, say, London, England, no one is smashing stores or burning cars, and the massive demonstrations are taking place in a democratic country that has free elections, free press, equal rights for women, and a vibrant economy with high growth and very little unemployment. There is no dictator to remove like in the Arab countries, no hereditary monarchy to overthrow. No one has downgraded Israel's credit rating, quite the opposite, actually, and there's no collapsing stock market or free-falling real estate value to worry about. So what is going on in Israel right now, and why, and what exactly does it mean? The answer is very interesting and perhaps unique to Israel. In essence, protesters are complaining about high housing costs because of the powerful economy and small country and slow building rates. Another factor might be the wide disparity between rich and poor in Israel, the fact that in spite of the prosperity Israel's economy is generating, the high growth rate in the new construction, the dynamic high-tech sector, Israel seems to have wandered from its original socialist ideals of a country without dramatic gaps between rich and poor, of a Jewish state in which the advocacy of peace would be an essential part of its very identity, of a country in which no one could slip through the safety net. Israelis want to believe that each new generation will have equal access to a decent apartment and a reasonable job and good health care, and that a diverse citizenry will have its rights and needs respected, not just protected. In effect, Israelis seem to be protesting for the very ideals that Israel was founded on, and for the country that we like to talk about here in America, the one that remains a beacon of light and hope in a very dark, brutal, and confused region. And, of course, the Israelis also want apartments they can afford to buy. Well, the very scope and energy of that protest movement in Israel, catalyzed in no small part of all things by popular music, has shocked the Israeli government and certainly the Jewish world in general. But please note, there have been exactly no incidents of violence associated with the hundreds of thousands of protesters. This is really a kind of summer of love in Israel. People seeking and strongly advocating major change to make Israel a kinder, gentler, more egalitarian place. Young people and their parents together marching and singing and meeting to push for a better, more idealistic Israel. Wow, it's actually kind of an amazing thing. Now, if only the mobs looting and burning parts of North London could be nearly as civilized as Israelis, the world would be a much better place. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So there have been enormous protests in Israel the last week or two. Nobody expected it, unpredicted. Tell us what's behind them, in your view.
Yes, there have been a lot of protest movements and especially tents. People, it started through Facebook, like anything else those days.
It's like Tahrir Square without the violence and without overthrowing the government.
Exactly. And with 300,000 protesters, was it not even one, you know,
no violence, no fighting, nobody killed, nobody injured, cars burned, no stores raided.
Yes. Well, I think the main issue here is that the major middle classes in Israel, which are mainly secular Jews, usually educated, find that the price of living, the cost of living in Israel, to be too high for what they can really afford. And it's starting with the price of an apartment, through price of food, through price of transportation. And that combines with other parts that are on their shoulders, like military service and actually anything else. Along the years, you know, the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredim, they don't serve in the IDF. They don't take part in that. And we need to remember, an adult Israeli secular serves 12.5% of his mature life
in the IDF,
in the army.
Either in active duty or on reserve duty.
Exactly.
Miluim.
Now, not only that, but the Haredim also are not part of the workforce. You don't see this in the statistics, because when you look at the statistics of unemployment, they're not in there because they're not considered to be unemployed as they're studying in their yeshiva. But they actually live on grants from the government, and they're not part of the workforce. So you know, the statistics lie. The other side, you would see another minority group of the Israeli Arabs that also don't take part in the military service, and they are part of the workforce, but you know, it differs. So those are two elements, combined with the fact that Israel is very small. There's not much land, so price of apartments become higher and higher, and most workplaces are in the center near Tel Aviv. So today, a young couple can't afford to buy an apartment in Tel Aviv. Prices of apartments in Jerusalem also went extremely high, especially because of a lot of people around the world.
Foreign buyers from France, South Africa, from the United States.
Yeah, you know, they buy the apartment there either from religious needs or because it's good economically. You know, prices of apartments in Israel
only go up.
Go up extremely. Right. So especially now with this worldwide recession, a lot of people around the world saw that as a great potential for investment. So they buy those apartments, and that also makes prices go up and up and up.
So, Guy, let's continue this discussion because it's a very interesting subject. Not only these huge protests, 300,000 people, but what it shows about Israeli society that's quite different from, I think, what many Americans perceive. Let's talk next week.
Okay.
Thanks,
we'll
Guy.
Talk next week.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wadler of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Janos is the finest restaurant in the Southwest. J-Bar are the most fun in all of the Southwest, I'd say, but they're also great places to hear music in the summer.
I think that's one of the things that makes J-Bar and Janos so fun in the summer is the summer music series. We have music every Wednesday and Thursday night out under the stars. And it's a really busy time, a really fun time for us, and great musicians, local musicians, but local musicians who also tour all around the world, and we get them at J-Bar.
You can sit outside, look at the stars, eat great food, have a drink, and just enjoy the summer with the summer music series at Janos and the J-Bar.
And I'll see you there, Rabbi. Give us a call, 615-6100, and we'll have your table ready for you out under the stars listening to the music.
And eating and drinking. What's the website?
www.janos.com. The full summer music schedule's on the web.
JNOS.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Palestine is supposedly going to be declared in September, and a lot of people that everybody in the Jewish world, most people in the Jewish world think of are terrorists, are suddenly going to be officially statesmen. It's an odd problem. How do you deal with the question of people who are on the one hand terrorists, and yet to their people they're freedom fighters, and then suddenly they become spokespeople or maybe even the more reasonable person to deal with in the side, and then maybe even statesmen down the road?
Well, I mean, this in a sense goes back to what we were talking about last week, which is it all in the eye of the beholder? Are there absolute human rights or humane ways of slaughtering, or, you know, is circumcision a real violation of the baby's rights because it doesn't have any say in it, or is it part of a long tradition that goes back to Abraham, who was the sort of founding father of all three major Western religions? I mean, this is a kind of the same question in another area, because one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. And part of it is who wins. You know, when Jews were living under the British mandate in what was then Palestine, and that was the only time in history really that it was Palestine, many of them were terrorists associated with one group or another. Some were so extreme that they were rejected by other Jews, but others were more mainstream and eventually became statesmen. And one was a famous leader of the Israeli government.
Yeah, Menachem Begin, head of Herut.
But, you know, not the only one.
Eventually the one who makes the great peace treaty with Egypt.
Right. So this is a question that appears in Afghanistan and Pakistan, really throughout the world. And in our own country, as you once pointed out to me in a distant conversation, The founding fathers were viewed as at least as traitors, if not as terrorists, by the British. I'm not sure that the word terrorist was used much before the French Revolution and le terreur.
The terror, right.
But certainly the idea that these people were guilty of sedition, treason, violence, et cetera, amounted to what might today be called terrorism. And, you know, they're our greatest heroes. They created our country. So I think this is a very complicated question to which there are no easy answers. And it's certainly not amenable to finding clear answers in a three-minute session on this most excellent radio show.
Well, then we'll have to come back to it again and again until we figure it all out.
We could do, or we could like offer a seminar in this, because I think it's really a long, historic, interesting question. I mean, there were terrorists in ancient Rome. You know, it's a long tradition, but really, it's not at all clear to me that there's some absolute definition of what makes somebody a terrorist versus a freedom fighter or a founding father or a national hero.
It's an excellent question, a complicated one, and sometimes an important one to answer, nonetheless. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We've been bringing you a Jewish joke of the week for 9 years now, and it seemed appropriate to have a special joke feature on this 9th anniversary show. While my wife Wendy and my kids Boaz, Gabriel, and Sipora still think essentially that none of our jokes are funny, or at least none of my jokes are funny, as Jeremiah once said, no man is a prophet in his own country. Anyway, I hope and pray that you guys think at least some of them are funny. Actually, you sometimes tell me by email and phone and in person, so I'm going to continue to pretend that you aren't just humoring me. To tell you the truth, I am tempted sometimes just to include the punchlines of jokes, since I tend to think most people have heard them before. And so, in honor of our 9th anniversary show, here's a new feature, frankly, a probably one-time feature, called the Top 10 Jewish Punchlines. Number 10, I can save the toilet, but the rabbi's a goner. Number 9, that I remember. Number 8, and before the rabbi and behind the rabbi, it was Shabbos. Number 7, okay, so one day mom went up on the roof. Number 6, he wants to be a doctor. Number 5, think of the odds we'll get on Yom Kippur. Number 4, her I don't like. Number 3, he thinks I'm God. Number 2, I wiped it on the curtains and she's still screaming. And the number 1 Jewish joke punchline of all time, number 1, from your mouth I should take it. Yes, that was the 9th anniversary special feature of Two Jewish, the all-time top 10 Jewish joke punchlines. The truth is, a lot of these jokes, maybe I can't tell on the air at all. But if you know the punchlines, email me at twojewishradio@yahoo.com and find out the rest of the jokes. Like the one about the rabbi who had a radio show and every week he tried to entertain, enlighten, and educate his audience. Oh, no, wait, there's no punchline to that one. Just a lot of happy gratitude from that rabbi for his audience. So, now it's time for our actual old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Shlomo is walking down the street one day when a filthy-looking, smelly homeless guy comes up to him and asks, "Can you spare $20, mister?" Shlomo replies, "$20? Will you buy alcohol with it?" The homeless guy says, "No, I don't drink." Shlomo asks, "You gonna spend it on cigarettes?" Homeless guy says, "Nah, I don't smoke." So Shlomo asks, "You gonna gamble it away?" And the homeless guy says, "I don't gamble." So Shlomo says to him, "Look, I'll give you your 20, but first you have to come home with me so my wife Becky can see what happens to a man who doesn't drink or smoke or gamble." That was the old Jewish joke of the week special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. You know, as a people, we Jews are good at many things. Kvetching, of course. Lashon hara, gossip, telling people things we shouldn't. And we're good at eating. But perhaps most importantly, we Jews are good at asking questions. Perhaps the greatest of all Jewish questions is asked in this week's Torah portion of Akev, third Sedra in the book of Deuteronomy. It reads, Ve'ata Yisrael, ma Adonai shoel me'imach, which means, and now, Israel, what does God ask of you? The passage in Akev then answers this question, that you have awe of the Lord your God, walk in all of God's ways, love God, and serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. This big question, what does God ask of you? And our portion Akev's answer begins a series of statements in Jewish tradition, a long attempt to distill from our large moral storehouse just what the essence, the ikar of Jewish ethics really is. What is it that God wants? What's the true standard we need to uphold to be considered morally good? The section in Akev lists a few things we need to do for God's sake. First, revere God. Second, walk in God's ways. Third, love God. Fourth, serve God with all our hearts and souls. And fifth and finally, we're told that we must guard and do all the mitzvot, the commandments of God. It's a clear, powerful list. Walk in God's ways, love God, serve God, follow commandments. 500 years later, the great prophet Isaiah distilled even those terse commands into a more concise version. Cease to do evil, he said. Learn to do good. And then he lists, seek justice, relieve the oppressed, uphold the orphan's rights, take up the widow's cause. A century later, the prophet Micah refined the formula again. He asked, what does God seek of you? Answering, only to do justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. And finally, Hillel, 400 years later, just over 2,000 years ago, said it most concisely, do not do to others what is hateful to yourself. All the rest is commentary. Now, go and learn the commentary. Of course, the assumption is that you will adopt one of these magnificent formulas. Whichever one you choose, it will be a high standard for how to live your life. But any of them will work, and you can achieve it if you choose to do so. That's what our portion teaches. After all, it's what God wants, and so should we. When we come back on our 9th anniversary show, to Jewish renowned feminist, author, and academic Susanna Heschel will talk about her father, the great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. When we come back on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The brutal Assad regime in Syria continues to massacre its own citizens, using tanks and artillery now, and has killed well over 2,000 protesters against the government. Torture and the murder of women and children are typical acts for the Syrian army in this war against civilians, and the UN and the world continue to make only lukewarm and half-hearted protest. Wow, this week the U.S. actually sanctioned a Syrian bank and a cell phone firm. No doubt Assad is quaking in his Italian loafers over that one, while continuing to send tanks in to blow up another protesting neighborhood. On the other hand, the announcement that Israel intends to build houses in a Jewish neighborhood in Jerusalem draws fervent U.S. protests from the highest levels. What exactly is the lesson here? In other news, Jewish poet Philip Levine, a Pulitzer Prize winner in 1995, has been named the 18th Poet Laureate of the United States. The appointment of Levine, who at 83 is one of the oldest poet laureates, was announced by Librarian of Congress James Billington. Levine, who's from Fresno, is the author of 20 collections of poems, including The Simple Truth, which won the Pulitzer. Philip Levine is one of America's great narrative poets, Billington said. His plain-spoken lyricism for half a century has championed the art of telling the simple truth about working in a Detroit auto factory, as he has, about the hard work we do to make sense of our lives. Levine has said about writing poems in his mid-20s during his days working as a factory laborer in Detroit, "I believed even then that if I could transform my experience into poetry, I would give it the value and dignity it did not begin to possess on its own. I thought, too, that if I could write about it, I could come to understand it. If I could understand my life, or at least the part my work played in it, I could embrace it with some degree of joy." Levine taught for many years at Cal State Fresno. He also taught at New York University, Columbia, Princeton, Brown and Tufts, and at UC Berkeley. And Elliot Handler, half of the pair that founded the toy giant Mattel, he's the L part of that, and the man who gave the name Barbie to a full-figured doll created by his wife Ruth, died July 21st at the age of 95. The iconic Mattel products attributed to Handler include Hot Wheels, now up to 10,000 models. I played with them a lot. Chatty Cathy, one of the first talking dolls. Mattel has become the world's largest toy maker with 31,000 employees, revenues of nearly $6 billion in 2010. Elliot Handler and his wife left Mattel in the 70s, but he continued to visit the company on an annual basis. He was known for insisting employees call him by his first name when such informality was unprecedented. Current Mattel CEO Bob Eckert said Handler has remained an important part of the company and showed a continued fondness for toys. In the early days, however, Handler may not have had the best business instincts. Despite giving Barbie her name, he was skeptical that the doll, a full-busted young woman his wife had modeled on a German figurine, would find an audience. "Ruth," he reportedly told his wife, "no mother is ever going to buy her daughter a doll with breasts." Apparently not so. Handler was born in Illinois, grew up in Denver. He met Ruth Moskowitz, his wife, at a B'nai B'rith dance for teenagers in 1929. Her family did not want her to marry him. He was a starving artist. The Handlers revolutionized toy marketing by going directly to children. They bought a year's worth of advertising, famously, on the new Mickey Mouse Club TV show in 1955. And in the late 60s, while looking for a toy for boys, he came up with the idea for miniature die-cast vehicles, Hot Wheels, whose customized designs and paint jobs now adorn 10,000 models, including some in my mom's garage. The Handlers also helped found Temple Isaiah in Los Angeles. That's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Susanna Heschel. She is the renowned author, academic, and Eli Black Professor of Jewish Studies at Dartmouth College. She's also the daughter of Abraham Joshua Heschel. Her new book is Abraham Joshua Heschel, Essential Writings, selected with a wonderful introduction and sort of structured by Susanna Heschel. She has also published extensively on the Jewish Jesus and is one of the renowned feminist voices in American Jewish life. In this great story told about your dad, that he was teaching at, he was asked to speak at Notre Dame, you know, kind of continuing the Catholic theme we had earlier today. And he came in and he walked in, it was a full lecture hall, and he said, "Today I saw a miracle." Got everybody's attention. He said, "The sun rose, I saw a miracle." There's so many great stories like that. Was he like that at home?
Well, yes, he was, but he was also very playful. But, you know, he was the kind of person who could be inspiring even without words. My father could express his religiosity even in the most mundane ways, just from watching him interact with the doorman in our building or buying something or walking home from Broadway to Riverside Drive in New York City in the late afternoon, watching the sun slowly set over the Hudson River, and he would point that out to me. And with something about even the tone of his voice that I felt was a source of inspiration. There's something very special about him, and always, not only in his writing.
It's amazing how much, I think he has more influence now than he did during his career, which speaks to the longevity and I think the power of what he did. How do you make the determination as to what you include?
Yeah, it's very difficult. And I had, of course, a page limit. But there were certain passages that I just loved so much. I'll just give you an example. There are some passages that aren't very well known. So, for example, in one place, my father talks about the importance of authenticity, religious authenticity. That is, you can't be Jewish the way your grandparents were Jewish. You have to be Jewish the way you are Jewish. And you have to know who you are. And I think that was something very important to my father. We have to know who we are, explore ourselves, have a lot of depth as human beings, as individuals, know who we are. And that's very Hasidic also. But he says, just to be Jewish the way our parents and grandparents were Jewish, that, he says, would be spiritual plagiarism.
Huh.
I think it's a marvelous
great phrase, spiritual plagiarism. Yeah. You know, there's an incredible, certainly not his best known passage, where he talks about blushing. He says, faith is a blush in the presence of God.
Yes, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it's fabulous. Just
yes,
a fabulous
faith
passage.
Starts with embarrassment.
Yeah, you know, and that first of all, that's a Jewish idea anyway, or it seems so to me. But, you know, such a gentle, thoughtful, and somehow insightful comment. I want to talk a little bit about your earlier work and some of your current work. You wrote extensively about Abraham Geiger, who is, I think, kind of a forgotten pioneer of Reform Judaism and of Jewish thought in the 19th century. Tell us a little bit about why you focused on Geiger in your early work and what it means that, you know, talk about Jewish Jesus and some of the work you ended up doing on the Aryan Jesus.
Sure. Well, I grew up knowing about all of these great 19th century Jewish thinkers. I knew the name Abraham Geiger when I was a little girl. And because of my father's studies in Germany and also the work that his friends did, my father's friends were all German Jewish refugee scholars. So I listened to their conversations growing up and knew these names. Then when I was in graduate school, I took a year-long seminar at the Jewish Theological Seminary with Ismar Schorsch, who was the chancellor. It was at a seminar in modern Jewish history. And I was assigned by Dr. Schorsch to give the presentation to the seminar on Leo Beck, who was a very great and wonderful Reform rabbi in Berlin who survived concentration camps. And he also was a friend of my father's. And I worked very hard on that, and I very much admired Leo Beck's writing. And I thought even about writing a dissertation about Beck. But then as I started exploring the context of Leo Beck's work on early Judaism, and he wrote also on early Christianity, I realized that much of it was derived from Abraham Geiger's work. Geiger wrote a couple of generations before Beck, and seemed to me to be the original thinker. And he set a pattern for Jewish understanding of Jewish history and also of the rise of Christianity. In other words, Geiger was the one who said that Jesus was a Jew who had no intention of founding a new religion. He simply wanted Jews to be more religious. And it was Paul who took Jewish monotheistic ideas and mixed them up with pagan ideas and created Christianity. Now, Christianity is the religion about Jesus. Geiger argued, it is not the religion of Jesus. So a Christian who's looking for the faith of Jesus would find it in Judaism. But what kind of Judaism? For Geiger, Jesus' Judaism was liberal, progressive, Pharisaic Judaism, the Judaism of the Pharisees, of the rabbis who eventually wrote the Talmud. Now, where would you find that Judaism? Well, Geiger said that Reform Judaism was not a rejection of orthodoxy. It's not a rejection of the Talmud, but rather it's a return to the religion of the Pharisees, to an effort to be progressive and liberal and democratic in our Jewish religious practice. So by implication, Geiger says, if a Christian wants the faith of Jesus, which is the religion of the Pharisees, where would he find it? In modern-day Reform Judaism.
Of course.
Right. So I found that a very clever argument, and even though it's scholarship is 150 years old, very ingenious in its day, and I was interested in the reception of it. And then subsequently, I started looking at later writings and Christian reactions to Geiger's work and The Next Generation. I found that Christians were very uncomfortable with the idea that Jesus was Jewish and that Jesus had nothing new or original to say, the way Geiger argued. And some of them started to turn to racial theory to say that even if Jesus' teachings were the same as Judaism, at least in his racial identity, he wasn't a Jew, he was an Aryan. That was their argument, which is a very problematic argument. And many of them became mixed up with the Nazi movement already in the 1920s. And so I wrote a book about that, about the attraction of certain Protestant theologians in Germany to National Socialism.
Yeesh. You know,
and that's my recent book.
Yeah, it was fascinating reading. And you know, the fact that they had worked so hard to sort of remove Jesus from Judaism is really frightening. One of the more interesting quotations about you is misunderstood, or perhaps deliberately so. That's, can you tell the story about the orange on the Seder plate, the real story?
Sure. I don't know how that story became so popular, frankly. It was just a small thing, but it goes back to the 1980s when once I gave a talk at Oberlin College, and some of the Jewish students there had gathered to create a Haggadah for Passover, and they made up a story, and in the story, a feminist Rebbe said, "We have a crust of bread on the Seder plate to represent the position of lesbians in Judaism."
Taka bread on Pesach, but never mind.
No bread. Of course. And I thought, well, you know, of course you can't use bread because it ruins Passover. It's transgressive. And I also didn't think that being gay or lesbian was transgressive. It's just normal. And I decided that I would represent some solidarity with gay and lesbian Jews who were too often marginalized in the Jewish community. And instead I used an orange, usually a tangerine. And I passed around the tangerine at the table, and everybody said the blessing over fruit. And everyone took a segment of the tangerine and also spit out the seeds. And did so just to remember those who were marginalized, gay and lesbian Jews in particular, but also widows, orphans, sometimes children who've been adopted aren't welcomed. It's a problem. Now, an orange has many segments, but they stick together. It's a whole. And I think as Jews, we need to stick together. And there are too many conflicts and too much anger and bitterness, Jew against Jew, for political reasons or all kinds of things. And that's a problem. Passover, especially, we need to come together as a Jewish community. So that's the original story. Somebody then went on and came up with a story that I had given a lecture in Miami Beach, and a man stood up and denounced me and said, "A woman belongs on the Bima like an orange on the Seder plate." And that story circulated, and I couldn't believe it, because what that story does is to take my idea and give it to a man. It removes the issue of homophobia altogether. And anyway, women are on the Bima, so what's the big deal?
Exactly. I you know, it's fascinating. I somehow, fiction is always weirder than truth, and so people like it better.
Some people may. It's too bad.
You know, I have to tell you that my grandfather was a colleague briefly at Hebrew Union College. He taught there for many years, Samuel S. Cohan, and he was there when your dad came.
Uh-huh.
And so we have family stories and legends about your dad, too. So very
nice
stuff and a nice connection. I want to thank Susanna Heschel for a great visit. It seems too short on Too Jewish, and maybe we can do it again sometime.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're very welcome. The book is called Abraham Joshua Heschel, Essential Writings. It's a lovely book, and it's great stuff. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish on this 9th anniversary edition.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, for our 9th anniversary show. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. We'll begin our 10th year of great Too Jewish radio with Professor Asher Susser, Senior Fellow at the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Tel Aviv University, and the author of Israel, Jordan, and Palestine, Challenges of Palestinian Statehood. And, of course, listen to all our Too Jewish podcasts on iTunes or at TooJewishRadio.com, or friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from the American pop rock group Safam, another version of the blessing for happy occasions and accomplishments, the Shehecheyanu. Thank you, God, for giving us life, sustaining us, bringing us to this happy day, and this conclusion of our 9th anniversary show of Too Jewish. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu.